The same trend has led to the alerting of small, old Quaker groups outside of America and England. There was an old group in Holland, there was a group in Germany, and there was a group in Denmark and in Norway. These groups now were made aware of the larger groups of friends in England and America. Many of them saw the service committee at work in its service and felt an interest in them. As a matter of fact, in countries where we worked abroad, like France and Germany, from nothing or from a very few members, the Quaker local group grew a little bit, so that there were yearly meetings established in Germany and in France and in Holland and in some other places. This led, you see, again to a more ecumenical idea of Quakers. These groups had formerly been isolated. So there is a world self-consciousness on the part of French. Now that's a big way to put it, and I don't want to give any of the impression that you sometimes get when you see a map and some little bit of an organization has a pin here and there all over the world, saying this is where, this is our spread. That's the most deceptive form of propaganda. There is such a map, I haven't brought it here, but I don't want to give this impression at all. But I will say that insofar as there were friends in any part of the world, they had a contact and a feeling of fellowship with friends elsewhere. And that's been fostered since the First World War by three world conferences. Of course, they had to be pretty small, but they were representative of groups of friends, not only in America and England, but also in the continent of Europe and in Asia and Africa and Australasia, a few delegates coming together. The first of these was in 1920, right after the First World War, where friends gathered together with the view of reconsidering collectively their peace testimony. The second one that was held in London, the second one in 1937, was held at Swarthmore and Haverford. At least the delegates were housed in these two colleges, and there was commuting. That was 1937. And at that time, the nucleus of a world committee was formed. Not a committee of control, but a consultative committee, as it was called, the World Consultative Committee. In order to foster this sense of fellowship among friends everywhere. That committee is still in existence, and it planned a third of these world conferences at Oxford in 1952, the largest and most successful of all. It publishes a newsletter a few times a year, and is therefore something that friends in every part of the world know. They're not subject to its control, but they can consult with it. It fosters not only these conferences, but interchange between the conferences. It has an executive committee that meets in between, and it is now planning a conference in North Carolina in 1967. But that would be a fourth of the series of conferences. That's a big byproduct of this new vision of Quakerism. Among the social concerns, which I said were renewed by this experience in social work or with a social problem like war, others have been included, like the race question and like economic questions. So that in the home countries and with some consultation internationally, these questions are debated mutually. And we in America find that there are other countries that have a race question, like South Africa, where there's a small group of friends, and there are other countries that have the problem, economic problems. Another sense of fellowship among friends has been produced by this situation, and that's not with other friends, but with two of the small pacifist churches. In America, and to some extent abroad, the Church of the Mennonites, and what's called the Church of the Brethren, share with friends a tradition of religious pacifism. And this bringing friends together has led to cooperation with them. In the Second World War, in the planning for conscientious objectors, a joint committee was formed, and it still is operating. And these groups have representatives meet once or twice a year, and there's personal things between the leaders and some cooperation in other ways. And I might mention another group, which is not a separate church group, the Fellowship of Reconciliation. It was founded in England in 1915, right after the beginning of the war, and in this country it began in 1916, and is a group of Christian pacifists of all denominations. And it's had a very useful influence in presenting the pacifist point of view to members of other churches by their fellow members in those churches. I think I mentioned to you the other day that the fact that it's interdenominational, because the fact that it's interested in peace, has led the United States authorities to withdraw tax reduction to givers, which is a serious thing for a charitable organization. Well, I'm speaking of that problem, and you know the law. You know that up to 30% of your income can be deducted from income tax if it's given away to charitable organizations, or is put religious or educational organizations. And a very strict ruling that if an organization is mainly involved in trying to influence legislation, then that tax exemption doesn't hold. The Service Committee found itself so close to trying to affect government policy, especially on such matters as military preparation, compulsory military training, the admission of refugees, and foreign aid, impartial foreign aid. I say we found ourselves so close to being involved in that and wanting to try to influence legislation that we devised a scheme of setting up, or encouraged the setting up, of another organization to deal exclusively with this sort of thing. And that's the Friends Committee on National Legislation, established 20 years ago and been operating in Washington. In plain English, it's a lobby in favor of the right of the kinds of bills that Friends would like to see pass. The word lobby perhaps has an unfortunate connotation of people that do something in their own private self-interest. If you do it in the interest of Jewish refugees from Europe or starving people in Asia, it's not quite such a selfish term as it seems. At any rate, in order that the donors to our larger undertakings, namely the relief work, might have the advantages of deducting their gifts from their income tax, this separate organization was established. And it has the same clientele in a way, all the American yearly meetings joined together, and it has carried on a very independent work and useful work. Well, that was another minor result. And now, what have been the effect of this work on non-Friends? Well, in the first place, a great deal of unsolicited publicity among unprecedented and unsolicited, and largely by newspaper, ambitious newspaper correspondents that wanted to find some story to write about in the magazine. There was a whole rash of those for a number of years. I don't think they're quite as numerous now, but they produced an awareness of the Society of Friends among non-Friends that hadn't existed before. I won't say a correct awareness, but at any rate, awareness. And the Nobel Peace Prize in 1947 made a lot of people hear of the Society of Friends who had never heard of it before. It attracted some people to the Society of Friends. Those that had studied the character of the work and knew about it through this publicity became interested. And without any advertising on the part of Friends, some of the results of advertising appeared after this. Some of the people understood the motives of the relief work, especially people in the countries which received it, and became therefore interested in knowing out of what background, out of what philosophy it came. That meant that the centers which we had in various cities had people applying to them to find out. And in England, America, the same thing. People wanted to know what it was all about. But as Richard Ullman said, in what I read to you, Friends didn't make much effort to explain. They were busy doing the job, and they didn't try to explain it. In fact, good many of them found it difficult to explain. It's a case where they acted first, and if they had time, they thought about why they acted, which is the way a great deal of life goes on. And therefore, we met occasionally. I remember one of our workers. Of course, we had a good many workers that were not Friends. And when somebody says to them, "What lies behind all this Quaker relief?" they say, "Well, I don't know, you'll have to ask a Quaker." And, or I don't feel that I can explain it. And then they come to a Quaker and they say to the Quaker, "Why don't you preach what you practice?" And that's a little unexpected remark to make. And the Quaker probably said to himself, "Well, I'd rather have it the other way around. That is, do the practicing and not bother about the preaching." So that I can say it's been a great recruiting ground for Quakers, for new Quakers. Quakers have never, in recent years, been very active propagandists. If a person becomes, in all to all intents and purposes, a Quaker, any point of view, and can prove it to somebody, they will admit him into membership. But they don't. They're not what you might call fishers of men, as the New Testament puts it. And therefore, though there have been small groups growing up, I said, especially in Europe, the countries we worked in, and even in other countries, it has interested them, and perhaps led some of them to do likewise. And this not only in Christian lands, but in non-Christian lands. Over the years, through our refugee work, we've seen thousands and thousands of Jews passing through our hands, either in European centers or being given visas and sponsorship in by friends in this country and in friends' meetings. And they have felt an interest in the people that were their benefactors. I won't say they've always imitated it, because the next list, the person I have on the list, are the Arabs. And the Jews whom we befriended don't seem to have gotten our ideas completely correctly in the way they've treated the Arabs since. In fact, they treated the Arabs, or perhaps they interpreted it, due to others, the way they've done to you. It's their version of the golden rule. And yet, both Jews and Arabs have, without any very little earlier contact, have come to be interested and perhaps to understand much of the relief work of the Fringe.